Grammar Girl here. I'm Mignon Fogarty, your friendly guide to the English language. We talk about writing, history, rules, and other cool stuff. This week, I have a great follow-up to last week's piece about the origin of Proto-Indo-European. We're going to talk about how humans actually started using language. Then, with St. Patrick's Day coming up, I have another follow-up about Irish calques. And finally, I have the delightful winning poem from the ACES National Grammar Day Poetry Contest. Bow wow, poo poo, ding dong. These are not the ramblings of a toddler having a little fun with newly learned words, but instead the humorous names given to 19th century theories on how human language got its start in our earliest ancestors. Most of us have probably wondered at some point how human speech became so much more complex than the way our pets or even our closest relatives, the apes, communicate. Turns out, we are hardly the first to ponder this same question. In the 19th century, discussions among scientists about the origins of language had grown so prolific and far-fetched that several European linguistic societies banned any writings or debate on the topic by the middle of the century. They didn't ban it because the question wasn't interesting, but because they felt it was outside the realm of linguistics, which they viewed as a field of science based on facts, not hypothetical guesses. Instead, they punted the ball to philosophers, who they felt more rightly dabbled in that sort of thing, but not before a number of well-known scientific thinkers had already provided their takes on our linguistic origin story. Not surprisingly, Darwin, with his interest in evolution more generally, had entered the fray early. In his well-known book, The Descent of Man, Darwin laid out his theory of origins, which was that human language had evolved over time as our ancestors imitated sounds in the natural world. For instance, the song of a bird or the howl of a wolf would have formed a sort of onomatopoeic proto-language, where early ape-like humans would tweet when referencing birds or howl when warning others of a fanged predator in the area. In Darwin's view, aimed at supporting his thesis of natural selection, this proto-language stimulated the evolution of our more expansive thinking. In other words, it spurred brain development, which was then naturally selected over time because people with better communication abilities and more developed minds would be more likely to survive. Darwin felt that during man's evolution from apes, early iconic imitative sounds, meaning ones that signaled to others about something in the environment, triggered mental abilities that in turn increased our linguistic abilities until both human brains and language fully developed. Though there were many thinkers at the time who had similar views, the German linguist Max Müller was a staunch anti-Darwinian, meaning he thought Darwin's ideas were poppycock. It was Müller who came up with the amusing and derisive titles like the Bow Wow and Poo Poo theories to mock both Darwin and others who put forth what he viewed as unreasonable ideas about how language emerged. Müller was particularly dubious of the idea that man's speech could have evolved from apes, believing instead language was a significant dividing line between man and beast. He presented Darwin's view as the Bow Wow theory of language, a riff on the idea of early ape-like man saying bow wow to represent a dog. Likewise, a closely related theory, and one also considered by Darwin, that language grew from early groans, grunts, and sighs, was labeled the poo-poo theory. In this view, the emotional noises an ape-like ancestor would make, say an admiring groan when seeing an attractive ape of the opposite sex, to use Darwin's own example, began to be used as a meaningful way to reference that hot ape, rather than just a response to it. Perhaps it's hard to imagine how grunts and groans would actually end up developing into language, but the poo-poo theory certainly might explain our propensity for swear words as an emotional response to banging our head on a low tree branch. Another theory mocked with a silly name, this time the Yo-He-Ho theory, suggested that language first emerged in protoform as part of our social nature. For example, from the sounds of hard physical effort, ah, oof, being made in unison during collective work to help coordinate motions. Besides criticizing others, Mueller espoused his own view on how language began. He believed that sounds themselves carried inherent meaning, an idea that also had its fair share of critics. In this view, sounds are somehow imbued with some quality of the thing they represent. For example, vowel sounds, such as E, might give a sense of something being small or weak. Think teeny. People gave this idea the amusing title of the ding-dong theory, and Mueller later tried to distance himself from it, claiming he had merely been referencing another scholar's ideas with the intention of being dismissive. Ironically, although this theory was not embraced during Mueller's lifetime, over the last few decades, a large number of studies have found that there does seem to be a limited tendency for such a relationship between sounds and the things they represent, like nasal sounds such as N or M appearing at high rates across unrelated languages in words for nose. However, considering that ding-dong doesn't exactly have a very scientific ring to it, today it's called sound symbolism. In another interesting development, later in his life, Mueller had a bit of an about-face and decided that maybe Darwin's theory of evolution wasn't such a long shot after all. In the end, none of these theories fully account for the origin of language, as they can't explain what triggered the move from making grunts and barks with rudimentary meanings in a present moment to making full sentences discussing vacation plans in the distant future. Modern theories are more concerned with if and how our brain wiring and capacity changed between prehistoric ancestors and modern people, and how this coincided with the ability for symbolic thinking, meaning using sounds or words to talk about things not immediately in our environment. But even if these theories don't explain exactly how we came to be talking the way we do today, modern theories still hold that our early utterances involved basic sounds, or perhaps gestures, that eventually became more sophisticated as our brains became more modern. So, just maybe, bow wow and poo poo still have some life in them after all. That segment was written by Valerie Fridland, a professor of linguistics at the University of Nevada in Reno, and the author of Like Literally, Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English. You can find her at valeriefridland.com. Next, you may remember that a few weeks ago, we talked about calques, which are literal translations from one language to another, like how many languages just literally translate the words for sky and scraper into their language to describe skyscrapers, and how Spanish speakers sometimes say they got down from a car or made a party because that's how those expressions are literally translated from Spanish. Well, after that segment came out, Grammar Palousian Aaron Moran asked me about Irish calques, and I didn't know off the top of my head, but I did know who to ask. Stan Carey, who is an Irish linguist with a blog about language called Sentence First, an Irishman's Blog About the English Language. And he directed me to a post he has about what he calls the hot news perfect, or the after perfect tense, because it uses the word after. And this very Irish-sounding structure actually came from calquing Irish grammar onto English. An example from Stan is something like, I'm after meeting them, which means I met them a short time ago, and we are just after eating, which means we just finished eating moments ago. I don't understand Irish, but Stan says it came about because Irish doesn't have a direct equivalent to the word have. So he says, quote, translating I have just done it into English involves be in one of several phrases meaning after, which gives you literally I am after doing it. So if you're listening to this a little late on St. Patrick's Day, when you're finished, tell the person closest to you that you're just after listening to the Grammar Girl podcast and you learned a fun thing about Irish English. Thanks again to linguist Stan Carey. Do check out his fabulous blog about Irish English at stancarey.wordpress.com. And that's C-A-R-E-Y. So yes, Aaron, there are calcs in Irish English. Thanks for the question, and thanks for being a Grammarpaloozian and supporting the show. Grammarpaloozians get texts from me a couple times a week with a fun language tidbit, can send in fam alert stories via text message, and can also ask me questions. If that sounds good to you, sign up for a free 2-week trial at joinsubtext.com/grammar. And a final fascinating tidbit that's different but also related to Irish is that I was surprised to learn that the word brogue, which describes a strong accent heard in some Irish people who speak English, comes from the Irish word for a kind of shoe, worn in what the Oxford English Dictionary calls the wilder parts of Ireland and the Scottish Highlands. These stout, rough shoes were made of untanned hide, and although the origin is unknown, one theory is that since apparently these brogue shoes were very specific, the meaning comes from the idea that it's the accent of, quote, people who call their shoes brogues, unquote. So that's fun. And I also learned that people still refer to a type of modern shoe as a brogue, most typically a leather men's shoe that looks a lot like an Oxford. In fact, a character in the movie The Kingsman asserts Oxfords, not brogues. But it turns out that what sets brogues apart is that they have decorative perforations called broguing. So according to multiple men's fashion sites, Oxfords can actually be brogues if they have decorative perforations. Sorry, Kingsman. Finally, National Grammar Day was last week, March 4th, and ACES, the Society for Editing, held its 14th annual National Grammar Day Poetry Contest. The first place winner was Leslie F. Miller, who wrote a limerick about a line from Hamlet. Here's her poem in her own voice, and because it includes a set of homophones, I'm going to quickly whisper the spelling where it's appropriate.
A man from a playwright historic, a jester from Denmark, not Zorich, had always penned your,
Y-O-U-R,
when he really meant your,
Y-O-U apostrophe R-E.
So we call him, alas, poor Yorick.
Leslie F. Miller works as a healthcare writer in Baltimore. She's the author of the nonfiction book Let Me Eat Cake, a celebration of flour, sugar, butter, eggs, vanilla baking powder, and a pinch of salt, which is not about baking cake, but about eating cake. A chapbook of arty and eclectic poems called Boy Girl, Boy Girl, and a forthcoming full-length poetry book called Words with Friends. I'll add that I was especially happy to hear that Leslie said she found out about the contest from a post I made on LinkedIn. You don't always know how you reach people, but in this case it's clear, and the world now has this great poem because my post inspired someone, which feels pretty great. Grammar Girl is a quick and dirty tips podcast. Thanks to marketing associate Davina Tomlin, digital operations specialist Holly Hutchings, director of podcasts Brandon Getches, marketing assistant Cameron Lacey, ad operations specialist Morgan Christensen, and audio engineer Nathan Sims, who loves to garden and started an indoor garden this year with tents and lights and hydroponics. And I'm Mignon Fogarty, better known as Grammar Girl. That's all. Thanks for listening.